Debt rating agencies defend themselves against criticism over the housing crisis.
And the European debt crisis.
And the U.S. debt ceiling crisis.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, July 27th.
Coming up, Moody's and Standard & Poor's go to Capitol Hill to talk about their actions during the housing crisis, but they also face questions about their involvement in the politics of the debt ceiling.
Also, why a default could be the inflection point of the U.S. economic empire.
And an Arizona couple about to lose their Medicaid coverage because of state budget cuts. That's a little bit later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Executives from Moody's and Standard & Poor's today are set to go before the House Financial Services Subcommittee for what's expected to be a grilling about repeated crises. Ratings agencies were closely involved in the housing crisis and the European debt crisis, and now the U.S. debt ceiling crisis, which we're going to talk about in just a moment. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is with us now from New York with the latest. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Steve.
So let's talk about these crises. Sounds like there are a lot of them to choose from. Which is Congress supposed to ask the agencies about today?
I know. Where to start, right? Well, what we'll hear Congress asking about is what's wrong with the rating system. We've had the world financial crisis. We've had a number of sovereign debt crises. But it would be a mistake to focus completely on the ratings agencies for this. They do have some culpability in the mortgage crisis. But analysts will actually tell you that the ratings agencies are right on things like municipal bonds, the ones from cities, and the ones from corporations. So what we need to focus on here is the housing crisis and mostly how ratings agencies make their decisions. I talked to Guy Labat. He's a fixed income analyst with Janney Montgomery Scott. And here's what he said about that.
I think the ratings agencies need to provide more information on the assumptions they use to establish the quality or lack thereof of a given bond.
Right. So basically what Congress is looking for is some insight into how these decisions are made. We want to know that they're not completely arbitrary.
All right. So if this is about the housing crisis, will they be asked, Heidi, about the role in the U.S. debt ceiling debate? I mean, some say they've been playing politics with the threats of their downgrades, right?
Right. Well, if they're playing more politics than the 536 members of Congress, that's really impressive. But actually, yes, they are going to hear about the debt ceiling debate. But it would be a mistake to blame the ratings agencies for our troubles. A lot of people say we should have been downgraded a long time ago. We're a huge credit, and we're talking about being a deadbeat.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore in New York. Heidi, thanks.
Thank you.
Republican House Speaker John Boehner's plan to cut the federal deficit won't get a vote today after other GOP House members said the plan doesn't cut enough. That adds to the anxiety that a debt deal won't be reached before the Treasury Department says the country could default next week. That means the federal government would take a big hit with higher borrowing costs, and local governments could be affected as well. From Portland, Kristen Foden-Wenzel of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
The Coin Cottage is a storefront in Portland. Owner Paul Rigby mostly buys and sells rare old coins. But he says this summer, small-time speculators are paying the bills.
I have clients that come in that are buying gold, silver, precious metals because of their concern about the debt.
Gold is seen by some as the safest investment. A debt downgrade would make everyone's loans more expensive, so many are locking in their mortgages now, or so says real estate agent Jeff Bale.
They've been sitting maybe on the fence watching properties and are deciding now to write the offer with hopes of getting into contract and locking an interest rate.
And then there are cities and local governments. They have to get loans to build roads and schools. The city of Portland is scheduled to issue $43 million worth of bonds next week. But Treasurer Eric Johansson says he might hold back.
If there's some uncertainty out there and you know, sales are getting pulled nationally, then we might just pull back and wait for this issue to get resolved.
Maryland and California have both put off bond sales recently because of debt worries. In Portland, I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel for Marketplace.
Some say a default would shake the global financial system to its core and shift markets away from U.S. Treasuries and away from the American dollar. Some skeptics worry the whole issue raises more questions about how long American economic dominance will last. Alan Beatty is international economy editor for the Financial Times. He wrote the book False Economy about the rise and fall of economic empires, and he's with us now. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Does the political situation here in the U.S. share any traits, do you think, with other economic empires at critical moments?
It kind of feels a bit like Rome in about AD 400. But, you know, a lot of this is kind of self-inflicted. The fact that the U.S. is genuinely contemplating defaulting on its sovereign debt is not something that's been forced on it by the financial markets. It's really being forced on it by an ideological decision that's being taken in Washington. So, if anything, it's even sadder and it's even worse than the end of the Roman Empire because it's self-inflicted.
If the future of an economy, Alan, is determined by people, as you argue in your book, how do you judge the current human capital in Washington?
Putting the words human and Washington into the same sentence is obviously always going to involve taking a bit of a risk. But there is certainly, I think, a worrying lack of experience and a worrying lack of kind of awareness of history. They'd never had to make compromises. They'd never had to make deals.
So looking forward, say, 100 years in the future, will America end up looking like the UK does today?
I think the US will still remain more influential than that, just because there is no real alternative country coming up. If you want a historical analogy here, you know, and it kind of checks out quite well, if you think of the British Empire as being a bit like ancient Greece, you know, and then it was supplanted by the Roman Empire, which is the US. But then when the Roman Empire fell, there were these tribes, the Vandals and the Visigoths and the Huns and so on, who were strong enough to burn Rome, but they didn't really have the size or organization to run, you know, Europe and North Africa the same way. So that's kind of the concern, I think. It looks a bit like you might get a power vacuum.
Alan Beatty, the international economy editor for the Financial Times. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Orders for durable goods, that's big ticket items like planes or computer servers, fell more than 2% in June. Economists had expected a small increase. Durable goods are items that are supposed to last a long time, at least 3 years to be exact.
I guess then, Stacey, it stands to reason that if you're worried about the long-term prospects for the economy, you're probably not going to be buying any of those durable good items.
No computer servers on my shopping list.
Exactly. So Richard DeKayser is an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us from Boston, as he is every Wednesday, to talk about that. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
All right, so the drop in durable goods was for June, which was smack in the middle of this debt ceiling debate. Is this the first hard data that we have showing real unease by business about a possible default?
I don't doubt that there is a lot of uncertainty out there, and I don't doubt that it's weighing on business behavior, including spending, especially on capital goods such as these we're talking about. But I wouldn't attribute the entire decline to that. Generally, these are the kind of items that do really well when the economy is doing merely well, and very badly when the economy is doing mediocre. So we've had a slow economy for a variety of reasons having to do with events in Japan, North Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and those surely are accounting for the bulk of the decline. I also think it's too early. In June, we really weren't on the precipice as we are now. So really, if to the extent that confidence is weighing on these actions, we're likely to see that in July, that is, rather than June.
We keep hearing the word default, the U.S. is going to default. What exactly characterizes default, Richard?
Well, technically, it is the failure to make timely payments on debt, whether interest or principal, and that would definitely happen in the event that we do not pass this debt ceiling legislation. Some have suggested that that same term could apply to other things, like failure to make Social Security payments. I'm not sure that definition holds up, but it might become in the end irrelevant in just semantics, because regardless, a debt downgrade, whether in the context of default or otherwise, would be very, very bad.
Richard DeKayser in Boston. Richard, thank you.
My pleasure.
New research published in the current issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says generosity could be the result of more than just social pressure of charity. Scientists at the University of California, Santa Barbara, did computer tests on whether evolution would select against generosity when there's no chance of payback, like when people tip a waiter they'll never see again. What did they come up with? Being generous could be evolutionary. Humans just really want to be nice. That's so nice.
I want to be nice, too, but sometimes it's not
you
possible,
nice,
Stacey.
That's not true. No, you're the nicest person.
Of course. You too. The numbers, you can check out the numbers and all the niceties of Marketplace.org are right there on the web, Marketplace.org.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Over in Silicon Valley, a patent war is breaking out. The battle's between big smartphone titans, companies like Apple and Google, who are in a race to buy up patents from defunct tech firms. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Apple recently spent $2.6 billion as part of a consortium that bought up thousands of mobile tech patents from Nortel Networks, a bankrupt Canadian tech company. So is Apple planning to use these patents to build great new stuff? Probably not.
They are using patents to slow down the competitors or even remove the competitors from the field.
Chetan Sharma is a mobile analyst and patent expert. He says when an industry expands as quickly as the smartphone market did, companies often end up using technology patented by firms that are no longer players, and they infringe on each other's patents, too. By buying up patents, they can force their competitors to pay patent fees and raise the price of competing products.
Additionally, it also allows the company to start a new revenue stream.
The next big prize in the multi-billion-dollar patent war is a company called InterDigital. Its only real assets are thousands of mobile patents, just what Apple and Google are looking for. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The state of Arizona is hoping to save at least $500 million by freezing enrollment in some Medicaid programs. Now, one of those programs covers nearly 6,000 people with serious medical conditions. Reporter Paul Atkinson wraps up a two-part series on the Medicaid cuts, and this morning has the story of one Arizona couple whose Medicaid coverage ends this week.
June Nelson sits behind several thick binders of medical bills. They document her breast cancer and back problems and the glaucoma, diabetes, and heart attacks of her husband, Bill.
I've had to do this to keep track of all the doctor bills because Bill has so many doctors.
He's had two heart attacks and needed 22 stents implanted to carry blood to his heart. The medical costs wiped out the couple's savings.
We were no longer able to afford our private insurance, and we had to ask the state for assistance.
The Nelsons are too young for Medicare. Bill's 60, June is 58. But 2 years ago, they qualified for a state-run Medicaid program. It's for people without insurance who have catastrophic or chronic medical conditions that bring their income below 40% of the poverty level.
This medical expense deduction program is something that was a godsend.
Nora Nunez is an attorney with Community Legal Services. She's helping the Nelsons after Arizona policymakers froze enrollment in the program to help balance the state budget. It cost Arizona $82 million a year. The Nelsons' coverage ends Sunday, and they can't re-enroll.
There is nothing they can do right now. I am still trying to find options for them.
One alternative is enrolling in a federal program for people with pre-existing conditions. But there's a catch. Enrollees must wait 6 months after their current insurance ends.
I was hoping that there would be an exception for people who clearly cannot afford to wait 6 months, but that is not the case.
Bill may not be able to wait that long. He's needed stent replacements every 6 months. His last was in early June. That means he may need a replacement before the federal insurance kicks in.
It's scary. It's very, very scary. We just don't know where we're going to go with this.
There's always the emergency room, but the Nelsons are still paying off emergency room bills from years earlier. In Phoenix, I'm Paul Atkinson for Marketplace.
And now the global perspective. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao today ordered his cabinet to conduct a public investigation into the bullet train collision that killed dozens of people and injured hundreds more last weekend. China's government has been trying to manage the public outrage, all the while worrying about something else, the country's plans to sell high-speed rail to other countries. From Shanghai, here's Marketplace's Rob Schmitz.
A few weeks ago, a Chinese official boasted that China's bullet trains were far better than Japan's. So superior, he said, that you couldn't even mention the two in the same breath. Since it started running 47 years ago, Japan's Shinkansen bullet train system hasn't had any collision-related deaths. In just a few years of high-speed rail in China, the death count is at 39 and climbing.
I think it has a very bad impact on their image. Of course, a lot of people already know that a lot of their equipment is inferior.
That's Edwin Murner, head of Atlantis Investment Research Corporation. He says the chances now of China exporting bullet trains to other countries is slim to none. He says China rushed its high-speed rail program, and thanks to that, it'll now start losing international railway bids to Japan and Korea.
Korea has a high-speed railway. That was delayed because the government found that a lot of the construction had not been done properly. So they just said, too bad, tear it out, do it again. But I doubt if the Chinese would do that.
Myrner is not alone in his doubts. In front of the Shanghai train station, Deng Zhiwei says this accident makes him doubt the government's competence.
Our government has no regard for human life. They just don't care. They need to put everything on the table and stop hiding the reasons for this crash.
An online poll this week echoed Deng's anger. 94% of those surveyed said they were extremely dissatisfied with the government's response. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
More than 100 new reality TV shows are in the works for summer and fall. A lot of them are focusing on beauty and fashion. But with competition like Project Runway and Say Yes to the Dress, is there really a market for more? Sally Herships has that story.
Wedding dresses, nail polish, jewelry, and the people who sell them. These are the focus of some of reality TV's newest shows. More than 20 are about fashion and beauty. Why?
Reality programming is about the lowest cost programming that any network can produce.
Porter Bibb of MediaTek Capital Partner says a typical reality show can cost just a quarter of what a drama would run.
They pay almost nothing to the reality talent, if you want to call it that.
But those amateurs seem to know how to make it work. Ben Grossman is editor of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. He says during tough economic times, viewers turn to reality fashion and beauty TV for more than fluff.
So you're not just looking to be entertained. You're actually learning to get something practical that you can use in your life. That's been a huge reason these things are so popular.
Not just with viewers, but with advertisers, too. Every time a manicurist opens a bottle of Flashbulb Fuchsia or Atomic Orange, everyone sees the designer label. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Finally this morning, Nissan today, Stacy, reported a dip in profits, but the Japanese automaker said it is repairing its earthquake-damaged supply chain ahead of schedule. Nissan is banking part of its future on its electric car, the Leaf. You've heard about this car, right?
That plugs in. Got a lot of press.
Nissan last week raised the price of the Leaf, and now the car maker says it wants to build some camaraderie among owners by creating a unique wave for Leaf drivers to use to say hi to one another when they see each other on the road. Like, oh, there's
like,
another Leaf
like
on the road.
A gang sign or
it
something?
Is.
Is this
it
what's
is.
Happening? Okay.
Could it be a variation perhaps of the simple high five salute or maybe a peace sign or the V for victory sign, you know? Well, considering the Leaf is going to set you back about $35,000, maybe the new gesture would be to show off your empty wallet to your fellow Leaf drivers. Just pull it out, throw it out the window. On Twitter, by the way, I'm at Radio Chio.
And I am at S. Vanek Smith. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.